here's Bob Glaser, who's going to talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly, I think, right?
Right.
Okay.
So, after the adrenaline rush of the last session, and I calmed down a little bit, I realized that I have violated cardinal advice that people... What's happening? People who live in glass houses oughtn't to throw stones. So I had only one thing to say to Yoshi after my aggressive questions, and that is, Yoshi, now it's payback time. He's too nice. All right, so the topic is in focus phase contrast, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Why do we anticipate that it's a good thing to do? There's no, even at Symbio, there's no such thing as a free lunch. So, you know, if we're going to get something good, we're also going to get something bad. And the research challenges are always ugly, but I say that with a smile. And I have two introductory slides. Possibly 95% of the audience is already on this page, and I don't need to do this, so I'll try to do it quickly. But the reasoning here, the logic is that electrons are not appreciably absorbed in thin specimens, and that the intensity, not the wave function, but the intensity that's transmitted through the specimen is constant. That's a simplification. It's not true, but you know, this is an approximation. It shows no contrast. Nevertheless, we know there is a lot of elastic scattering, even though the intensity is constant. So how can things be scattered if the intensity isn't variable? And the answer, as all of you do know, is that the phase of the exit wave is spatially modulated, even though its intensity is not. And the traditional way to express that is to take a light microscope analogy that we have a plane wave, uniform intensity and uniform phase wave function approaching a glass slide with some tiny microscopic glass balls on it. And because there is no absorption, the transmitted intensity is constant. But the optical path length through different parts here is not the same, and as a result, the information about the structure is encoded in the phase of the transmitted wave function. So this is a class, and I'm supposed to be teaching it, so I think I have only one more slide along that line, which are some quotations from the published version of Czernicka's Nobel acceptance speech titled How I Discovered Phase Contrast. And there's a paragraph that in particular I thought was especially apt, that speaking about an image of the exit wave, we're going to image that exit wave function with an absolutely perfect microscope. No aberrations, it's going to be in focus, etc. And Czernicka pointed out to his audience that the image of a phase object is absolutely invisible in the ideal case. If you fix spherical aberration, you're in focus, the image will be invisible. Sounds like a bad thing to do. I loved it that Czernicka went on to say, the practical microscopist has never been content with this physical explanation. Matter of fact, he never even found it out. He just simply adjusted the focus until he could see the tricky details, the transparent details. Sound familiar? It's this thing that we all do all the time. Czernicka also went on to say something that I think is particularly apt to this time in the development of electron microscopy, he said, how quick we are to learn, that is, to imitate what others have done before, and how slow we are to understand, to see deeper connections, and slowest of all is to apply old ideas to a new field. Now, I think phase contrast is a pretty old idea, and how slow we are to apply this to the new field of, no, in-focus phase contrast. We've always applied defocus phase contrast. Now, the point is, and my talk will illustrate, that the contrast you see here of Groyel particles, a side view and so forth, an image that Steve Lutke gave me a while ago, that contrast could be much higher if we had Zernike phase contrast for the electron microscope. And furthermore, this image has been obtained by tweaking the fine focus control of the microscope to put it a little bit out of focus. If it were in focus, this would be absolutely flat. You wouldn't see anything at all. And to get that contrast, we've had to corrupt the high-resolution features. And you all know this, the oscillations of the contrast transfer function. But I want to go into that and look at that statement a little more detail and more quantitatively. So the contrast transfer function oscillates. Here is a plot of the CTF for 3.5 micrometers defocus and 300 keV. The horizontal axis is 1 over the spatial frequency, not the spatial frequency. So you can look at these numbers. They're nanometers. This is 100 angstrom resolution, 10 angstrom resolution, 1 angstrom resolution, 1,000. And I'm going to be drawing more attention shortly to the fact that it's the information from about 200 to 300 or 400 that you're seeing when you look at a defocused image. You are not seeing the 100 angstrom resolution. You aren't seeing that. You certainly aren't seeing the 50 or whatever. And I'm going to document that in a second. So when we crank the image out of focus, we're getting a tiny little bit of phase contrast in the spatial bandpass that's important for seeing the particles, and that's why it's so difficult to see them. If we had in-focus phase contrast, we would have a transfer function that looks like this black bar. So first of all, the contrast would be flat over all spatial frequencies. It would be, in the ideal case, 1 in the bandpass that I spoke of as being important. It would drop to 0 at a low frequency, as does the defocus, for a completely different reason. And I guess I'll wait until I get to that point to come back and explain that if it's not already obvious to you. So, fortunately, there is a nice example that shows that in-focus phase contrast actually works as expected. This is a pair of images, just like the one from Steve before, embedded in vitreous ice, imaged in this case, I think, with 2 micrometers defocus of Groyel. And this is not the same field, but a totally equivalent one, imaged with in-focus phase contrast, where the what I call the cut-on frequency, the lowest spatial frequency at which phase contrast starts to be applied, was actually close to 500, a Bragg spacing of 500 angstroms, or spatial period of 500. Although the work is unpublished, I think it will be published very soon. I'm very grateful to Kuniaki Nagayama at the Okazaki Center of Integrative Bioscience for allowing me to show this at meetings. I've been showing it for a number of months at different meetings. And Rado Danev gave a talk at the most recent Gordon conference showing these results. So I'll show a little more later in another slide to illustrate what this statement says. In this case, the Zernike phase contrast was produced by putting a thin carbon film, continuous carbon film, over the entire open area of the objective aperture and then drilling with a focused ion beam a tiny, tiny little hole at the center. So the unscattered electrons go through the hole, experience no phase shift. The scattered electrons go through the carbon film, and the electrostatic voltage inside a carbon film, not because of charging, but just because the Coulomb potential of the nuclei shielded by the electrons, there is a DC voltage difference as you go through the carbon film, and that's what gives you the phase shift. So for the I'll draw your attention to it already. If you're not already asking yourself, you know, what are these white halos around these objects? Where do they come from? And why are they not always symmetrical? And I have a possible explanation. I can offer a hypothesis about why that's the case, but I don't know that it's correct. And there are other hypotheses that, in my prejudiced point of view, I think, nah, it can't be that. But some of you might find that I should include more than one hypothesis in my perspective of what can account for that. We can talk about that during discussion. Dieter Tipke did the simulation shown here to provide something more than speculation about the question, what is the lowest spatial frequency that needs to be given the phase shift of 90 degrees? And so you'll recognize that this is an image of negatively stained tobacco mosaic virus. Some of you can see the 23 angstrom layer line as an internal spatial frequency calibration bar on these simulations. And start in the lower right, that if you have something that prevents the phase contrast from being applied at low frequency, and it only phase contrast cuts on only at a spatial frequency 1 over 10 nanometers, so 100 angstrom resolution, the more I look at this, the more I can actually see the TMV rods, and they don't look all that bad. But the first time I saw this, I thought it was invisible. If you go to lower spatial frequency, that looks like, you know, a 2 or 3 micrometer defocused image, high voltage EM image, cryo EM image. If you go to 300, it's beginning you might say, that's actually good enough. I'd be glad to take that. Thank you. But 400 is better. And even 500 still, you know, is not a perfect, but I'd say 300 is minimum, 400 is what we should aim for. Wish I could get 500. So this is a text slide to summarize what I think some of the improvements are. You know, what would be good about being able to do this in practice, and then I'll support that with individual slides. This is sort of an outline for the next part of my discussion here. I'll show you a slide that explains why I say it should be really, really easy to box particles whose molecular weight is as small as 200 k. And since these will be taken at focus or close to focus, we don't have to correct an oscillating CTF for these small particles. Currently, as you know, you have to crank up the focus to 5 or 7 micrometers. If you thought it was bad at 3.5, you know what you're going to get if you go to 5 or 7 micrometers defocus. We won't have to do any of that. There's an effect that is on people's radar screens, but not at the level that it ought to be, that when you take an image at high defocus, a lot of the information that you want in your reconstruction is delocalized. It's shifted off of the footprint of the particle. If we take images in focus, no longer a problem. Glaser hyperbolizing again. Truth in advertising, there is a delocalization problem due to spherical aberration if you go to high defocus, but that's the least of my worries. I'm worried about the big guy, the delocalization from defocus. And I think you'll probably agree when you see a couple of slides here that it probably will be possible to take an image that's got many particles in many different conformational states and subclassify those so they're initially in a heterogeneous population. Probably be much easier to create much more homogeneous subpopulations if you record the images with in-focus phase contrast. So we'll be able to do that more accurately, and we'll be sensitive to much smaller differences than we currently are with defocus. So these are what I personally expect to be the improvements that will come from this development effort. So a little drama and hype. If you had a choice, who would buy this microscope if you could buy that one? I can stop. You know, my talk is finished. So incidentally, I was going to ask the organizers if they wanted to encourage discussion during the talk. So I've just been plowing through here and stupefying the audience by my enthusiasm. There we go. What's the expression? Penny wise and pound foolish. You'll get much more bang for the buck. And I'll accept the commission from from the manufacturer whose name I'm going to mention pretty soon. Every lab that's doing cryobio EM, isn't that cute? I liked it. All right. Every lab that's currently doing cryobiology or cryo EM with biological specimens will be in a queue to be able to get the money to deliver that, get a microscope that does that. And like light microscopes, I don't think manufacturers will sell a microscope intended for biologists unless it is fitted to do in-focus phase contrast. That's going to come in a couple of years. It reminds me of the aphorism that human beings tend to overestimate what will be done and what will be accomplished in the short term, but underestimate what will be done in the long term. And here's my effort to estimate what will be done in the long term. All right, so now we're getting a little more serious, again taking something from Nagayama and Danev. a little field that very cooperatively has an example of GrowYell in an end view and GrowYell in a side view. And in the end view, you can imagine carving this into 1/7 of its volume and being dead easy to box that particle. A little more difficult in the side view, but I could cut this guy into quarters, molecular weight 800,000, cut it into something 200K, and I would have no problem boxing that particle. And remember, that's in focus, so there's no CTF correction, at least out to maybe 8 angstrom resolution, as you'll see shortly. So, I don't have data to back up this statement, but it is it seems very, very likely to me that if these guys have subtle conformational differences, it'll be much easier to identify them in an image like this than an image like Wah wanted to have. All right, so now the question about delocalization. This is a paper that is almost ready to submit for publication. If my other well-wishing friends didn't keep telling me they want me to write this, that, and the other paper rather than this one. Bridget and I always have to have some little in-jokes between us at these meetings. All right, so one might say, if you take an image, this is 3 micrometer defocus, you all recognize which mysterious large macromolecular complex whose coordinates are in the PDB I'm talking about. It's the large subunit of a ribosome. Simulation of what such an image looks like, noise-free, simulation of what it looks like at 3 micrometers defocus. And if our experimental data were noise-free, and we boxed a large enough area to include all of that delocalized information, then doing a CTF correction would give us back this. This is what it should look like. This is what it is expected to look like with in-focus phase contrast, without, and then you add noise. So if the signal-to-noise ratio is 30, then you can effectively compensate fully for it. So what do you think happens if you have a signal-to-noise ratio that's more like what we really have in our EM images?
Bob, could you go back? Maybe you should just say a word about delocalization so
okay.
It's clear that everybody understands
okay.
It's about.
Yeah, glad to. So the explanation of what is delocalization that is comfortable for everybody is that the image formation process, you know, has a contrast transfer function. That's the Fourier space representation. The real space here is you take that contrast transfer function, do a Fourier transform on it. That tells you what the point spread function is. It tells you that a direct delta function will be imaged as some oscillating ringing disk of some kind. And then you convolute that point spread function with the actual mass density, and that's what you get. So that's the comfortable way for people to think about it. Nico, wherever you are, and I like to think about it the way a crystallographer would think about it. And this object has many different spatial frequencies in it, just like a crystal does. Let's pick just one of them, because our imaging process and our thinking is a linear process. What happens for one of these spatial frequencies will happen for all of them. So when you take a particular spatial frequency and apply a defocus to it, so given spatial frequency in the object, gives rise to a diffraction spot and its Friedel mate in the diffraction plane. Take one of these and apply the phase shift due to defocus, and the phase shift corresponds to a lateral shift of that spatial frequency. And the other one, unfortunately, gets shifted the opposite way. And where they overlap with each other, so what I've just described are single sideband images. And where they overlap, as they shift, sometimes they're in phase and you get contrast twice of what it would be otherwise. Where they are out of phase, you get zero. And where they don't overlap, you do have single sideband images. So this is the superposition of a continuous spectrum of Fourier coefficients of single sideband images. Nobody in their right mind ever said we should apply a CTF that's appropriate for double sideband images to single sideband images. But I did apply a CTF correction, and I applied, in this case, it's really Ken Downing did the computations, applied the mathematically best CTF, which is called the Wiener filter. So you can do phase flipping, you can multiply by the CTF, you can do fancy stuff of dividing by the CTF where the signal is good and setting to zero elsewhere. None of those will give you a reconstruction that is as close to the real object as a Wiener filter. Wiener filter is derived by the criterion, what correction can I apply that produces something with the smallest mean square difference from the true object? And he turned the crank, and it turns out it's quite a simple formula for how to do that. So this is a Wiener filter. Don't think you're going to do better than this by doing some other kind. So where the signal to noise, most of us, for single particles, aren't going to even get a signal to noise as good as 0.3. But already, even for that optimistic estimate, notice two things happen. This image has changed from that, and that was the purpose. It surely doesn't look like that. And the ringing has gotten worse. And what this is, I love to tell this part, this image, we're calling that a defocused image of that guy. But Dennis Gabor thought of this as being an intensity record that has preserved phase information. In other words, Gabor, when he first conceived holography, did so in the context of looking for a way to correct the problem of spherical aberration in electron microscopy. And he said, take a highly defocused image and then restore it. And so an inline hologram and a defocused image are absolutely the same thing. They're just different names for what is the same thing. So what he found out is that when he applied a restoration with optical methods, he got restoration of about half the signal, and the other half went into what's called the twin image. So CTF correction in holography has long been known to have a twin image problem. And the twin image problem is nothing but the half of the delocalized information delocalized again by the operation of CTF correction. And so CTF correction perfectly restores, apart from the zeros, the information where it overlaps. But on the single sideband, it brings back half, but keeps the other half out there as some kind of noise. And this one I don't have to talk about. We just want to... So that it gets better, you know, it's recovering more of the twin image as the signal-to-noise ratio gets higher, but we're never going to have such high signal-to-noise ratios. So the point is that if you thought, I don't need in-focus phase contrast, I'll just get all the contrast I want by cranking up the defocus as much as I need to and making the illumination as parallel and coherent as possible so I won't, you know, have an envelope function killing me, you'll do half as well. Well, not even half as well, because there's zeros in the information. You have to take more images to recover. So there are a lot of reasons why it seems worth the effort to try to implement in-focus phase contrast. Now, we have proposed, and now you better be careful what you ask for. You might get it. And we have gotten a four-year NIH grant to try to implement some of these objectives. And in this, we proposed, and we're currently waiting for microscope manufacturers to tell us what they will sell us, proposed a microscope that has effectively a focal length of 20 millimeters, not 2 millimeters, but 20. And the point of this slide is to say that if they provide that to us, this instrument will exceed the requirements of everybody in this room, or 99, you know, how many are attending? So 95 of us in this room, your requirements will be exceeded by this. So here's a calculated CTF for this instrument. Would have a focal length of 20 millimeters, a CS of 10 millimeters. We would take the images at 600 angstroms out of focus in order to compensate CS a little bit. And out to 5 angstroms, we'll have, you know, from 400 angstroms to 5 angstroms, we would have virtually flat contrast transfer function. This simulation is, so 400 to 5 angstroms. Simulation is for a 100 kV microscope. That's in order to get a little more camera length out of this. And the simulations assume that the product of the energy spread of the gun and the chromatic aberration coefficient of this crappy long focal length objective lens, that product has a value of 5 EV millimeters. It may be necessary to have a gun monochromator on this instrument to narrow the energy spread. But if it's a field emission gun, there'll be plenty of intensity. You can still fry your sample in 1 second with this microscope, even if you throw away some of the electrons. For some reasons that I hope I'll make apparent in a future slide, you'll have to collimate the illumination much more than you normally ever do. So we want it parallel to at least 2 times 10 to the minus 5 radians. I would have used to tell people you should collimate to 1 times 10 to the minus 4 or 10 times 10 to the minus 5. I'm now saying you ought to do even 5 times better than that, and that's going to raise some experimental challenges that you might be interested to know about. But first, if you think that 5-angstrom resolution is not good enough for the biological molecules you're looking at, and if you say, I would like to have another 2 angstroms so I don't have to do CTF correction for this last frequency, then you can pay more money and get a CS corrector and knock it down to 1 millimeter. Of course, you could take it to almost zero, but just to show you, if you went to 1 millimeter, then it's flat out to 3 angstroms. So I think this will exceed the requirements for a long, long time. All right, so how am I doing on time? The bad. What do we have to do in order to reach the goals that I've set out? You could use carbon film phase plate, and Nagayama's lab is doing that, and a couple of other labs, and I think a lot of labs in the world will be doing it very soon. The bad thing about that is that some of the signal is lost, and I have a slide explaining this to follow, because the scattered electrons that you want to get a 90-degree phase shift, many of them will be scattered by the carbon atoms themselves. They won't just get, some will get a phase shift. They'll go through unscattered but have a phase shift, but many will be scattered inelastically or elastically due to the atomic structure of the film that I've kind of suppressed up until now. So this is a great stopgap approach, but I think ultimately we would like to have a way to get phase contrast that doesn't have this kind of minor drawback. You can buy an instrument that does this, and to a substantial extent overcomes challenge of charging of the phase plate that I haven't yet talked about. So you can buy these commercially from JOL. And I think every other manufacturer ought to jump on this very quickly. And otherwise, they're missing. Our science would be much better if all manufacturers offer carbon film phase plate. But I and a couple of other labs want to go beyond that and achieve the phase plate with some kind of electrostatic device. And I'll show what these things mean. One of these is called an Einzel lens. It's just a biased electrode with a hole in it that electrons can go through. That's sandwiched between 2 grounded electrodes to control the fringing fields. And the unscattered beam goes through the hole, and you'll see a picture of this if you're not already familiar with it. I'll show a picture shortly. Drift tube I have to explain with a picture. Now, if we fabricate these phase plates using optical microfabrication, that means kind of 1 micrometer feature size, we cannot make such devices small enough to get the low spatial frequencies that we need. If the microscope objective lens has a standard focal length of 3 millimeters, and that's why we're going to a much longer focal length in our proposal. Whether you use the electrostatic or the carbon phase plate, what you're going to get in the bargain is you have yet another fiddly element that you have to align and deal with and prevent from getting contaminated and so forth. For some reason, the aside flashes on my mind that in my office I have a bookshelf that's 8 feet tall, and human nature tends to make you want to put big, heavy things on top of the bookshelf. A safety guy comes in and says, you can't do that. And of course, being facetious, you respond and say, oh, no, that's my earthquake detector. I need something. There's fiddly alignment. It's going to turn out that this is your charging detector. Yoshi told you, the beam can be deviated a little bit if the sample charges, and boy, you'll know about that right away. Okay. Using a phase contrast aperture forces one to use illumination that is as parallel as it should be, you know, 2 times 10 to the minus 5. Now you're going to have to. You can currently get away with and think you're okay, but it's okay. So here's the cartoon I was alluding to earlier, that this is how Nagayama's lab accomplished the phase contrast that I showed. Specimen, the objective lens, unscattered electrons get focused on axis, scattered electrons get focused off axis. So you put in a continuous carbon film with a little tiny hole drilled into it. Scattered electrons get a 90-degree phase shift, added to the 90-degree phase shift from initial scattering itself. And now the scattered waves, when they recombine with the unscattered, are either in phase or against phase, giving you lots of contrast according to how big their structural phase change was. And about 1/4 of the scattered electrons, however, get scattered again. So that's the downside of the carbon film. This design was first brought into practice at this small size scale by Rasmus Schrader, who if he hadn't started to do this, I probably would still be saying, don't do in-focus phase contrast. It's too many downsides. But Rasmus did this, and as soon as I heard a verbal report from it, I could have had a V8. You know, I should have thought of that myself. So this is terrific that he recognized this. And there are other people, Max Heider and Harald Rosa, I think, who should be credited as well with these developments. But Rasmus is the one who took it to the experimental level. And it's pretty big. You know, the low frequencies are being cut off at a radius of 7 diameter of 7 micrometers. Here's a blow-up of the inside, and you see, as I said before, there's a flat conducting electrode made out of gold in the middle, insulated on the top with aluminum oxide, silicon nitride below, and then 2 more grounded gold electrodes. And the scattered beam gets focused and goes through that hole. The scattered beam goes through these areas. And there's a relative phase shift when the bias voltage is the right value. It's around 200 to 300 millivolts for this device, for the voltage on the center electrode. So this is called an Einzel lens. I've explained all these text points here. The last thing to mention is that this was proposed by Birch in 1947. Kind of instantly. So how quick one is to imitate something that has been thought about before. Zernike realized you want to have a 90-degree phase shift, and Birch was on it in a millisecond and published it. It's kind of amazing that a proposal saying this is how we should get phase contrast in electron microscopy would be published at a time when there was no inconceivable way at that time to make something of the appropriate size. Maybe physicists live in a different world than biologists do, and they can get away with doing this kind of thing. So John Jin is a physicist engineer at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. In discussions about this, came up with an alternative design that we call a drift tube. So here we have a normal grounded aperture with a big hole in it, and then at one edge, by microfabrication, you have some of the grounded material, coming out, and then you have microfabricated into it a little beam that is connected to a biased electrode. Blow it up, so this beam terminates in a cylinder with a length about 10 times the width of the features. So here's our biased electrode. We focus the electrons to go through that hole, and we have surrounding it a grounded electrode to keep the fringing field small. And you might worry the fringing field would be huge, but electrostatic calculations show it's so small you really can ignore it completely if the aspect ratio is 10 to 1 or more. And this has been published earlier this year along with an experimental demonstration that look at the tone rings here. An image recorded With no bias, an image recorded with almost 11 millivolts, and the tone rings are shifted by, you know, the maxima are replaced by the minima and vice versa. The experiment to show that the contrast transfer function is flat was not taken at quite the right bias voltage, taken at 9 millivolts, and realized afterwards because the theoretical simulations said it should be 9. But those didn't take into account the fact that there is a bloom of voltage above the device. And after we did things correctly, we can explain that we didn't have the bias set quite correctly. So these are background subtracted power spectra of two images, one taken without a bias and a defocus of 4 micrometers, and the other with a bias and essentially zero defocus. And they are described roughly by the same envelope function, but the one that's taken in focus with the phase contrast turned on is, you'll all agree, that's flat, right? So there's a huge envelope, which, among other things, we're using our J100C that was about to be thrown away before we said, no, I need it. We're running it in what the manufacturer sold is the high contrast mode of the microscope, which is the long focal length mode. And, of course, it has much bigger aberrations. Has a tungsten filament, so we have no spatial coherence. And as I'm going to show you, this thing was charging really ugly, big time, really bad. So there are many reasons why we still have such a big envelope function, but it at least is proof of concept that it isn't oscillating. Now, this is the slide that gets into the nitty-gritty on the point that if we have a focal length of only 3 millimeters and we go to take the worst case, 300 kV, so the wavelength is 2 picometers, and imagine we could make a fabricated device that has a radius of 2 micrometers, then the first frequency that would begin to feel the phase shift is 1 over 3 nanometers, no, 30 angstroms. We're way off of what we have to have. So the cut-on frequency is a factor of 10, too high frequency. We require that it be at least 1 over 30 nanometers. And just kind of a fun slide, doesn't really mean anything. It is a really exaggerated example to show if you put one of our devices in and look at the diffraction pattern and you get the unscattered beam going down through the hole just fine, that you can't use any of the electrons scattered here. That's an optical nightmare. You want to start out here where it's well shielded. And in this case, you start at a spatial frequency of 6 angstroms, you know, 1 over 6, 0.6 nanometers. This is a gold ring at 2.3 angstroms. So we can reduce this device size factor of 5 from this example, but we still need to increase the focal length a factor of 10. And Dieter Tipke, we found the manufacturers, all of them. So if I blame one, I'm blaming all of them, to be extremely refractory to the idea of going back in time and making it an electron microscope with a focal length of 20 millimeters. They just simply were not interested. Of course, once you have $2 million, they become interested. But, Dieter had to tell them how to do it. Now, those of you who don't know Dieter, he was Scherzer's last graduate student, and he pretty darn well knows how to do optics and knows about aberrations and that sort of a thing. So here we have the specimen, the objective lens, and the electron diffraction pattern. And what he is saying is the first thing you want to do if you have to have a longer focal length is to magnify that by having a transfer lens that has two elements. The first element looks at the plane where the diffraction pattern is and produces a magnified version of the diffraction pattern, and then you put your phase plate device in that plane. But also at that plane, you know, this is in the middle of that lens, and the lens here, you think of it as the equivalent, you think of the thin lens that's equivalent to the real lens, and its principal plane should be where you have the magnified version of the diffraction pattern, and then you use that to produce a, I've got to get this right, a demagnified image, because if you magnify the diffraction pattern, you know, reciprocal space means 1 over, so when you magnify the diffraction pattern, you demagnify the image. You produce an in-focus image here, which is then looked at by a standard intermediate lens to magnify, and off you go. This introduces aberrations. There is no free lunch. If you shorten the increase the focal length, you get aberrations. But this is a much better way than just make a weak objective lens, which has really big aberrations. You get much better. You do get aberrations, but they're not nearly as bad. So the transfer doublet does increase CS and CC. And as I indicated, if CC worries you, you can buy a microscope with a corrector. And if chromatic aberration worries you, buy a microscope with a gun monochromator. But there will be another stage of something you've got to align, the aperture and this extra lens. You want to keep things in the para-axis, or you want to keep things parallel to the optical axis and so forth. And that's where automation comes in. All of these fiddly things should be 100% transparent to the user. You shouldn't even know it's happening. Just like the light microscopist doesn't know that there isn't any contrast in a phase contrast object, you just change the focus and there you are. So automation becomes even more essential the more fiddly you make. So who would fly an airplane without automation? At least I hope my pilot on Southwest doesn't do it without some computer assistance. All right. So the things that we don't know yet is, will we be able to get the device size even smaller, you know, to 2 micrometers or less, using ultraviolet light photolithography rather than visible light photolithography? Can we put technology in place that really will rigorously prevent contamination and charging of the device? I'm not talking about the specimen. I'm talking about my phase plate. One idea, and this is what Nagayama does with his, is he heats it to roughly 200 C. Is that good enough? I'm not so convinced. Another idea is we could bake out in vacuum and then cool it. So even though it does become contaminated, the contamination can't go anyplace. This is a very effective technique. Or we could think of having a differentially pumped thing and turn on an oxygen plasma cleaner and leak it into the column of the microscope and, you know, people in scanning EM do this. It's actually a really good technique. All right. So, and can automation be? Will automation fulfill my vision that the use of this will be transparent to the user? We have to show that. I'm getting close to the end here. This is a feasibility study on using ultraviolet light photolithography, showing feature sizes, both the electrode width and the gap, 0.4 micrometers. So this is not the geometry we'd want in the final device, but shows that it is possible to fabricate things like that. That was actually a foregone conclusion because that's been known from fabrication of Fresnel zone plates for X-ray microscopy. You know, we still had to do it. Not shown here is we want to now sandwich top and bottom what we've done here. We want to sandwich it top and bottom with grounded electrodes so that the fringing fields from these electrodes won't interfere with a portion of the spatial frequencies. And this is just to show you that with the experimental setup we have now, the 100C, no way of preventing contamination. Charging is absolutely dreadful. So you can see the ghost of my drift tube electrode coming in. Why is it in both sides? Because we're recording an image intensity. And when we take the Fourier transform, what we get has to be Friedel symmetric. But it's really only coming in on one side. There's the unscattered beam. It's still outside the device. You get the most weird and wonderful optical phenomena that I don't want to try to figure out where it's coming from, but it's got to be from charging and huge astigmatism. Put this guy in, you get almost round tone rings. But of course, that's not good enough because it's charging, and that charge is fluctuating in some pattern, and that's giving you a big envelope function. So First of all, we want to make it so that you get a perfect shadow of the device without any disturbance of the tone rings. That's the first criterion of charging. And then the next is when it's centered, that the envelope function will be just as good when it's in as it was before you put it in. And final slide to acknowledge Ken for having done some of the simulations I showed. He did some of the very first experiments with the device, and of course, we're talking to him about it all the time, and that's extremely valuable. And Dieter Tipke did nearly all of the experiments. He did the simulations of the tobacco mosaic virus and the design concept for how to magnify the diffraction pattern. John Jin is the engineer who came up with the concept for our design, his design. Rosanna Cambier has done all the engineering type analysis of the mechanical stability and the fringing fields. She's done the microfabrication. John has participated in a number of the experiments. And we have the wonderful asset of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory that's able to provide seed funding for ideas that NIH would never buy into until you had preliminary results. And Gatan also supported us through a cooperative research and development agreement, and we're now funded from NIH that began October 1. So thank you.
Questions for Bob?
Let's start here.
So you... of Groeyel with the phase plate. Well, what about in 3D?
Yeah. So I think in work that will be published pretty soon, Rado Danev has collected a 3D, well, he's processed enough images to do a 3D reconstruction. And he's done it with and without the phase plate. Recording data on a CCD camera, something you should never do. Under not optimal conditions. And in both cases, both reconstructions went to 14 angstrom resolution. He could get the same resolution with, I don't remember the number, 80% or 70% of the ones he had to use with conventional. So what he needs to do, and I'm partially serious about this, or let me be even more serious, what he needs to do is collect data at higher magnification, so that, or on film, and so he can get higher resolution. Maybe then the conventional will go to higher resolution, and if it does, the only physically reasonable explanation in my mind would be that the phase plate is charging and has a worse envelope function.
So how long do you think how long will it take to make these commercially available?
The carbon phase plate configure, JOL is offering, you can buy it. I don't know what the price is. It shouldn't be that much more. It might be $100K more. They insert the transfer lens, relay lens, but they don't magnify. That may change really soon. But at the moment, they have a commercial available instrument that relays the diffraction pattern to a lower plane, and the phase plate goes in there. Phase plate goes in on a material scientist hot stage. So you can heat it, and it's not going to drift by more than an angstrom per second or something like commercially available hot stage for high-resolution work has to be very stable. So you can buy commercially something that you can put in a carbon phase plate and at least work with the prevent the contamination that heating of the aperture will prevent. So I think a lot of wonderful work can be done in the next few years using such an instrument.
Fred?
Why should we buy yours if Nagayama's only loses a quarter of the electrons?
That's a really good question. I'm surely glad that the reviewers of my grant proposal didn't ask that question. So the improvements, I would say, are incremental. So it's always better to get all of the electrons rather than lose only 25% of them. But There are other things that may or may not be important that I can list. One of them is that one of the features that's available, and I won't call it a benefit, but one of the features available in an electrostatic phase plate device is that you can tune the contrast. This might become important with thick specimens and tomography, which are no longer weak phase objects, and the ratio of amplitude and phase contrast, you know, might be better if you can tune it. And how thick the sample is and so forth, you might tune differentially. This is really a stretch, but that is a feature. You can tune the phase contrast. I think the more important situation will come down to which is more practical to use, and the thing I'm thinking of in particular, which device is it more practical to avoid contamination? So if we really have to go to the oxygen plasma cleaner, the carbon film is not the thing you want to use. You know, it'll eat it up.
One other question, which is, Intel's making 60 nanometer feature size transistors, so why can't you make your device smaller and not have to go to all the trouble of demagnifying the image?
The big issue is not to to fabricate it to begin with if it's sitting on a silicon nitride window, but to lift it off. And the smaller you make it, the more fragile it is. So we think within the 4-year period we might actually get to the point you're referring to, Fred, that we'll be able to make something that can go into almost any microscope and doesn't need the relay lens. But we will try to do the things that we're pretty confident that our preliminary data show we can do first, and in the meantime, out of our hip pocket, work on some of these other goals. I think the answer is no. You could put a carbon film, and some people in the world are doing this. They put a carbon film on the objective aperture, drill a hole, and put it into the ordinary aperture holder. That guy is guaranteed to contaminate really quickly. Mike Marco says it doesn't in his microscope. And he says he doesn't know why that is the case, but he knows of other microscopes where they does contaminate very rapidly. So pretty cheap to try it and find out. And if you're lucky, go for it.
I just wanted to give a historical note. I think the first phase contrast image, at least that I know of, for a biological specimen was done by Nigel.
Don't go there. Don't go there.
It was actually done by Nigel in the mid-70s, I think. And you can do it with stuff you have around the lab.
Yeah. I don't need that. So some people, you know, present company excluded, but some people have wondered whether those were phase contrast images or were they attenuated F-naught images.
Oh, come on.
I said present company excluded.
No, that is absolute nonsense, Bob.
All right.
Contrast rings, they're flat out to about 5 angstroms where spherical aberration comes in. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
You can decide on how much of the direct beam you attenuate. You can attenuate very little, or you can attenuate a lot. You get a lot of additional contrast over what you'd get with your carbon film. And just because you get additional contrast doesn't mean to say it's not working.
It is a complex situation in which there is some attenuation, which is not necessarily a bad thing.
It's a good thing, actually. Yeah, in the light microscope, better contrast that way.
As long as you're not shot noise limited. I think that you get more contrast but less signal because the phase contrast image comes from the interference of the scattered beam with the reference. And if you reduce the reference, then you get less contrast. I think the signal to noise is preserved if you work out the math. But The other thing is we're busting our buns to avoid our phase contrast plate from charging. And it doesn't sound too encouraging to me to go to an approach where you rely on charging and you can't control how much you're charging it while you control the illumination. This is not a personal attack, as you know. Okay.
Does anybody dare ask you a question? Anyone else? Well, come on. How about somebody junior that would like to ask a naive question?
This is a course.
When do you think you saw the first image? Do you have a kind of point?
I'd rather answer a related question of what is our goal, our target, as opposed to what I think will happen. So I hope that we will have the microscope with a longer focal length delivered in January 2009. It surely isn't going to come in January 2008. So I hope it'll come in January 2009, and by June of that year to have some results that we're happy with. You know, so June of 2009. That's my goal.
Nico?
You wanted a naive question. What do you think is going to, what does the carbon film do? Does it retard or accelerate the electron beam?
I'm not certain I caught the question. You're asking me if I think that the carbon film phase plate accelerates electrons or decelerates them.
Yeah, how does it achieve the phase
shift? Yeah, so the average value of the potential inside the carbon film is positive voltage. And so the negative electron will be accelerated when it enters the carbon film. And that changes its wavelength.
I had a question, I think, mainly for Nigel, which is to ask, you know, you did this a long time ago. Why did you stop pursuing it? I mean, did you find some alternative method or decide it wasn't worth it?
Bob is right, it charges up, and I could control the charge by heating the aperture to about 200 degrees and irradiating it with a strong beam. And it would last for about 50 hours, and you could get very good phase contrast with that, and you could see it quite clearly with the tone rings. There's no doubt about it whatsoever. And the trouble was that it was quite hard to make these phase plates, and I did some image processing with them. They were negatively, this was in the 70s, so negatively stained things then. And they did show some different information than you would get in normal bright field images, which was useful to me at the time to tell which way to go in the future. The thing was, at that stage, it became clear that, you know, radiation damage was the main problem, and it was best just to use, we felt, just to use ordinary bright field images and correct for defocus the way everybody does. But I don't see anything wrong. I think it's a very good device, actually. It's a much smaller diameter wire than you've got. It's about 0.3 microns in diameter, so you can use it normal without doing anything fancy with the lenses. And I think that the problem is it's just difficult for people to use it. At the time, it was very difficult to manufacture. But I believe, actually, some thought should be given to that, because it's just a matter of you make use of the fact that the things tend to charge up, and it's just a matter of controlling it. I don't know how you could do that, but heating isn't the best way. I think you'd need to sort of have a laser in the microscope or something and just wash it over the laser beam every now and again, something like that. But that is an alternative approach, and I don't think it's right that you should just sort of say that it's not phase contrast at all. It definitely is. Produces very beautiful images, I think.
Yeah, so just to correct the wrong impression I gave you, I did not mean to say it's not phase contrast at all, but I was meaning to say there are additional things happening of which, you know, attenuated F-naught is part of it. The point that Nigel is making that I want to strongly agree with is that one could pretty easily with microfabrication make an insulating, if you wish it to be insulating, you could make many configurations of a I'll call it a beam stop, although I'm not doing that in a snide way or anything. You could make a wire that the electron beam should hit. It could be an insulating wire, it could be conducting, whatever you like, that's really quite small, rather than taking nature's method of making it. Then there's the technical challenge, the good, the bad, the ugly. The ugly is controlling the charging to be the amount you want. As part of that current effort, one should physically model hypotheticals. If the charging were Q coulombs, what would be the field distribution? So a really ugly thing about, and I'm not saying the experimental results didn't exist, but I'm saying what we want to understand physically about it is that if you really had a point charge on axis and no grounded surfaces anywhere, then the phase shift everywhere is the same, and it's infinite. The line integral of a Coulomb charge that goes from here to infinity is infinite. Now, you get out of that by having grounded surfaces, so it doesn't go to infinity. How do they affect the distribution of the field, and how uniform is the phase shift? One could go that route. I think the Einzel lens or the drift tube is probably the way we'd go now.
I was just hoping you could explain a little bit further about those asymmetrical halos you were pointing out.
I, like many others, I'm recovering from a cold. You probably saw me blowing my nose a couple of times. My eustachian tubes are a bit plugged. Or alternatively, you could say, Bob, you're getting old. You ought to get a hearing aid. But I did not hear your question. Turn the mic up.
I was wondering about the asymmetrical halos you pointed out, and if you could describe
the asymmetrical
halos around the Grolier particles.
Oh yes, good.
And could you explain more about that?
I'd forgotten all about it. Let me put them up so that. As kind of a crutch. Come on. Here we go. What we do know is that if the phase contrast aperture is not centered, or if the unscattered beam is not in the center, it's to one side, then we give a phase shift to some spatial frequency, to one diffracted beam, but not to its Friedel mate. And Nagayama has taken advantage of that by using not a carbon film with a hole, but a carbon film with a straight edge. And so he brings that straight edge as close as possible to the unscattered beam. One half of the diffracted beams get a phase shift, the others do not. Now, if that were an absorbing thing, you could call that Schlieren optics, if that meant anything to the current generation. Or you could go back in physics and call it a Foucault contrast image. In electron microscopy, we've tended to call it a single sideband image. That's if one half were absorbing. It looks like the first derivative of the function that you're studying. Now, if you make that carbon film twice the thickness, then you get a pi phase shift, and Nagayama calls that Hilbert contrast after a mathematician who transform is involved here. And again, it looks like a first derivative. So you might say, I don't know it's true, but you might say that this guy is kind of the has a strong component of the first derivative of the phase difference. And some other guy I can find has one and is pointed in a different direction. So now I'm starting to worry that at different places in this specimen, ice embedded, no carbon film, it is going to charge, and it's going to charge differently. And I'm suspicious that the unscattered beam going through here gets deflected that way, and the one through someplace else gets deflected another way, and we're getting some components of kind of single sideband or Hilbert contrast. So we have to be able to hold the unscattered beam parallel to the direction it was when it came in and parallel to the optical axis to this phenomenal tolerance that you don't have to if you're not getting so much contrast.
Are there any other ways to make your device other than lithography?
Are there other ways to make lithographic ways to make things even smaller? Yes. I'm not sure if I have a slide that I can pull up handily, but you know, we've shown it in other situations. We've also done a proof of fabrication capability using electron beam lithography. And in this case, the strategy is really simple. You start with a resist. You write whatever electrode structure you want with an electron beam. You develop that, so you remove the exposed stuff. That's now a mold. And you fill that mold with gold. And those are your electrodes. And so we've shown that we can get down to feature sizes of only 50 nanometers. Now, you know, lifting them off is going to be fun. And there you go. But you know, we've got 4 years to try to achieve it.
Other questions?
Yeah, I was going to ask, since Nagayama has a carbon, at least in the first device that you explained here, he has a carbon film in it with a hole, so the beam goes through the hole and has no phase shift.
Right.
And all the diffracted beams go through the carbon film,
yes,
and have a 90-degree phase shift.
Right.
So if instead of doing that, you tried to make a device consisting of a thin carbon film,
right,
the direct beam went through,
right,
and then all the diffraction pattern then would go through the empty space and wouldn't have this 25% energy loss, and you'd be depleting the direct beam, so you'd get a bit of the increased contrast.
Right.
And of course, you'd need 300 angstrom thin carbon film, 0.3 microns, and so on.
Right.
So, why is that not easy to do? If it's charging, couldn't you just use a lower beam current and take a longer exposure so that the charge has time to leak away?
Yeah. So, should I restate the question, or did everybody hear it pretty well? The idea of a kind of beam stop design 90-degree phase shifter device, when somebody suggested that to me, I was all gung-ho to do it. Having the right thickness of carbon of such small dimensions means it almost certainly is going to have to be supported on a frame. So it's going to have the same, you know, it won't have the advantage that a hole has, that you can start with the phase contrast right away. So that's one of the downsides. Probably the showstopper is that the intensity of the unscattered beam is going to be 100 times more than the scattered beam. And that means that knock-on collisions are going to sputter the carbon away. You're going to eat it away. You're going to destroy it very, very quickly. And that scared me off. But if somebody else wants to go there, it might be a winner. Yes?
I had a different question. You make a carbon disk, and you're supposed to shift the phase by a certain amount, but there's variations in the carbon density. So if you were, let's say you had a crystal where you have very skinny diffracted beams, I'd worry that the phase shift for one beam relative to another beam wouldn't be quite right.
Right. And right. So David raises a concern that many people have raised about the carbon phase plate. We know that the carbon evaporated carbon films are not optically homogeneous. If they were, we wouldn't see phase contrast granularity. There must be fluctuations in the projected Coulomb potential that have significant structure, and so there'll be fluctuations in the phase shift for different spatial frequency beams going through different parts of the carbon film. Now, you might think that working with a competing technology, I ought to jump on that and embrace that criticism and say, that's what's wrong with
it. It's a question.
Okay. So I'm an enormous defender of the carbon film phaseplate because that one, it turns out that if you have a phase shift of 90 degrees or 70 degrees, the cosine of that is so close to 1, you aren't going to worry about it. So it's quite tolerant, for up to a certain point, and then it starts to scream away from you. But I think the granular texture and structure of carbon film probably isn't anything that's going to affect the quality of the data.
What are the advantages and disadvantages of that Hilbert faceplate, where you just have half of the beam block?
Of half, yeah. I think the disadvantages or the things I don't like about the Hilbert transform, the half plane, things I don't like about it are sort of aesthetic or emotional on my part, that I would rather work with the function itself than its first derivative. If I have to massage it to undo the fact that I'm looking at the first derivative of the function, then that's going to be subject to noise. But half of me can argue against that and say there's no problem. It's fine. But the advantages of it are that with a very precise position control on your phase plate, you can get it really close to the unscattered beam for zero technological difficulty in making a sharp edge.
Since you're on this Hilbert thing, since we're discussing the Hilbert plate, you mentioned before you only get a factor of 2 improvement when this is working absolutely perfectly against highly defocused bright field phase contrast.
On the delocalization.
On delocalization, But what about the comparison? Supposing you blocked off half of the diffraction pattern completely, so you have a pure single sideband image.
Right.
Do you then get all the low resolution diffraction, and it's just you've lost the factor of 2? So, but you could be going on with that in the meantime.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. So, in a previous incarnation, in a previous life, I was a big enthusiast for using a totally absorbing sharp edge aperture for Foucault or Schlieren optics. And the showstopper so Steve Hayward even tried to do this experimentally. And the showstopper is we could not heat it hot enough to prevent the contamination that when you bring the central beam very close to the And Ken Downing, wherever he is, consumed a number of months or more of his thesis career trying to do single sideband and discovered that fluctuating charging, you know, gave you a killer envelope function.